Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
So for a long time in the show now, we've been talking about CTE. You might remember we spoke to Dr. Bennett O'Malley around the time of the release of Concussion. And to continue the conversation, because it's far from done, I'm delighted to welcome to the show Kimberly Archie, who is founder of the National Cheer Safety Foundation and a leading expert on the prevention of child athlete maltreatment. Her legal work has been used to settle more than 50 sports injury lawsuits since 2008. Kimberly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you get involved in child safety in sports?
In 2003, my daughter was injured on her high school sideline cheerleading team. And it was through that experience that I was able to see that there really were not rights for kids in sports. I mean, in the U.S., you can clearly see, like, Thurgood Marshall was the legal engineer of civil rights for people of color. And then, you know, now, especially lately, a lot of fanfare about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her fight for women's rights and being the legal engineer of that. And so I saw that there were not laws to protect kids in sports. And so that's how I got involved many years ago and have been involved ever since.
Your son, Paul, played youth football from the age of about 7 to 15, isn't that right?
That's correct.
Did you have any concerns with Paul playing football? We're obviously talking, youth NFL here, not as opposed to soccer. We've kind of got translation issues with different audiences, but we're talking youth NFL.
Yeah, so American football, my son played from 7 till 15, so he was still playing when my daughter got injured in cheerleading. And one of the things that stood out about my daughter's cheerleading injury is that it seemed that there were more issues in cheerleading than, per se, my son had in football. So he had a really great experience during the time that he was playing. We weren't aware. He didn't have injuries. He had a really good coach who cared about the kids, and it wasn't about winning. So other than when he first started playing, I did wonder why the helmets were so big for kids. But I certainly didn't suspect at that time that the helmets weren't made for them or that they would actually make brain damage more likely to happen. So we were just really unaware. We thought they had done everything that they should do to at least have the minimum standards to keep kids safe.
And did Paul ever come home with concussions or any head complaints?
No. No, he never had any known concussions or brain injuries while he was playing football. He didn't have any outside of football either. By the time that he passed away when he was 24, he did have migraines and headaches and other things that I didn't necessarily at the time attribute to all the repetitive brain trauma he had sustained in football. But certainly when I got the news of the details of how he died and how it just didn't make any sense. It didn't add up. And it reminded me of another former NFL player who had crashed into a semi-truck and died. And then also when Junior Seau, who's one of the most well-known NFL players in the U.S. to have been found to have CTE, had driven off a cliff a couple months before he committed suicide. And so my son's death reminded me of those incidences. And so that's what triggered me to have his brain examined for brain damage and CTE.
Please feel free to go into as little detail as you're comfortable with here. But when you say his death didn't make sense to you in many ways. He passed away in a motorcycle accident. Were there certain things that flagged for you as being unusual or inexplicable?
Yeah, there's a laundry list of things. That's why it was so bizarre. Number one, I didn't know he had a motorcycle. That was hidden from me. I'm not a fan of motorcycles. I often get trolled on Twitter about why I don't do motorcycle safety. Anyone who knows me knows I'm not a fan of motorcycles. So the first thing was that he had a motorcycle and had no experience and that it had been hidden from me.
Right.
My son was not a rebellious person. He wasn't rebellious as a kid, as a young adult. And, you know, not that kids tell you everything. I'm not that naive of a parent, but he was able to share quite a bit with me. And so for him to hide the fact that he had this motorcycle, he knew it was wrong to have it. You know, we live in Los Angeles. This is a dangerous place in a car, much less a motorcycle. So that was the first thing. And then, you know, had he been just driving fast, per se, maybe on a lonely road or on a racetrack, driving fast also wouldn't have stood out to me. But he was driving home from work, you know, on a pretty busy street on a holiday, and he hit a woman and her two kids. And that's what stood out to me the most, is that it just seems not just reckless, but crazy, almost suicidal. And the fact that he could have killed someone else, you know, driving fast and injuring yourself is one thing. That's sort of reckless behavior that you might think just anybody might do when they're not making the best decisions. But he was a really sensitive person. So for him to put other people in danger, he could not have been thinking straight at all. And he was driving into the sun. He was driving in the number one lane, which is next to parked cars. If you're crouched down on a motorcycle, people pulling out are not going to be able to see you.
Yeah.
So it just, it was all these factors that to me just didn't make sense. And it obviously you start at that moment, in a moment of crisis like that, you start looking back all of a sudden at all these things that are flashing before your eyes. And all of a sudden they're all adding up to, hey, wait a minute. this doesn't look good. We need to find out more answers. And so for me, you know, having his brain looked at was a logical thing. I had a younger daughter who had had stage four cancer. And when they removed her kidney, we donated that organ to science. I mean, so it wasn't the first time our family's been involved in trying to help science keep kids safe and to find cures for diseases.
You mentioned he'd been suffering with migraines on occasion. Was that anything out of the ordinary? Was that something he did struggle with even in his early teenage years, or was that more something in adulthood?
Well, it more so as the years had gone on. So not so much like as a young kid. You know, there were signs back in late part of high school where he started having some more difficulties dealing with his emotions or processing things or having, you know, a shorter attention span and just telltale signs of brain injury. I mean, some people think CTE is a big mystery. It's not a mystery. CTE is advanced brain damage. We know an awful lot about brain injury and brain damage, which is where CTE starts. And so, you know, any of the brain injury symptoms that are common can be suffered by someone who has had repetitive brain trauma and may later develop a neurodegenerative disease like CTE or Parkinson's or ALS or dementia. So, you know, he had some of those signs in the years preceding, and he obviously had brain damage and brain injury for many years before he died for it to develop into CTE. CTE doesn't happen overnight.
Sure. And was the diminished attention span or maybe trouble with his emotions? Because again, look, you're in your late teenage years. Maybe we all struggle with emotions or different things at that period of our life. There's a lot going on. Certainly life changes very quickly. Was it of concern to him? Was it of concern to you? Did you have it investigated at the time? Or did you think, well, look, maybe this is just the rough and tumble of life we're going through here?
A little bit of both. I did attribute some of those things and to being a teenager and being a young adult and trying to figure out who you are and all that kind of stuff. I think those are the logical first things that anyone would sort of go to because of his age and all the things that you go through trying to be an adult, trying to get a job or go to school or figure out what you're going to do with your life. That's a pretty difficult time, I think, for most people.
Yeah.
I also think that toxic masculinity is fairly common here in the U.S. So for, you know, when people hear, oh, he's driving fast, they just think everybody drives fast, which, you know, especially a teenage, you know, boy or whatever. But I think taking risks that can endanger other people and yourself in a highly probable scenario isn't just being a teenager.
Yeah.
To me, that's being extremely reckless and can cause damage, you know, to property and lives. I also found out after he died that he had mentioned to his older sister that he wondered if he had CTE. You know, this is my life's work. So it's not uncommon for us to talk about at a meal or, you know, just sitting down chatting about okay. sports injuries or brain injuries or CTE or particularly the NFL case, which I worked on for many years, 3 years before my son's death. And anyone who knew my son would also say he was my number one fan. He loved to tell my NFL stories to other people, and you know, it was a hot topic in our family because it was important to us. Sports is a huge deal here, and you know, whether you stop playing or not, your world somewhat still revolves around sports.
Yeah, I'm actually glad you mentioned that point, because somebody listening might just presume that you've become very interested in this fear since your son's death and the discovery of CTE, but just by a cruel twist of irony, you were probably one of the most informed households in the country and the planet when it came to CTE before that. So it's not shocking that he may have wondered that aloud to his sister. He would have been familiar with CTE, or certainly with the concussion issue in the NFL.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was definitely a topic that had come up a lot. I'm in the Super Bowl previous to his death, I had gone to New York and went to a lot of the events and media day and gone, you know, to a lot of the stuff related to the game. And he was really bummed that I didn't take him. I actually took another athlete who'd been injured cheerleading, and it was her bucket list dream to attend Super Bowl. So not knowing that would be my last chance to take him, I was taking another injured athlete to make her wish come true. And so, you know, even after his death, my daughter and I attended Super Bowl year before last in my son's honor, just sort of, you know, go full circle and, you know, face football head on, so to speak, and attend, you know, the game and try to reconcile the difficult issue of loving sports, trying to be an advocate for football as a game, and for kids as well. But once you lose a child from the egregious behavior of that industry, not doing the right thing, it's definitely something that you grapple with, because, you know, you feel guilty to still think sports are good or important. People attack you and say that you want the game to die, or you're out to stop it. You know, I get a lot of that sort of topic, when really I've been saying the same thing for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And had met with Roger Goodell, the commissioner, previous to my son's death. I met with Jeff Miller, who's now the vice president of health and safety, and discussed with them some of the things that could be done to make the game for the long term more sustainable.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt, and the audience you're talking to here are very familiar with all of this stuff, and there's no doubt the NFL had their head in the sand, willfully their head in the sand, for quite a long time on this issue. When it came to your son, when it came to what was happening in a youth American football, which is a sphere I'm less familiar with, I must say, how extensive was the damage? And are we concluding that this was just the repeated, I suppose, shaking of the head, frankly? I mean, it doesn't have to be head-to-head contact, as we know. It can just be the whiplash effect, I suppose. Anyone who's seen concussion, it was demonstrated quite brilliantly in the example of a balloon in a jar, for instance. So how extensive was the damage, and is that effectively what caused the damage?
Well, yeah, you know, so to answer your question on sort of in two parts, to have CTE at all is advanced brain damage. So he had white and gray matter changes. You know, he obviously had the markers for CTE. So he had, you know, the tangled tau. And he also had a thin corpus callosum, which is where the left and right hemisphere of the brain are connected.
Right.
And I mentioned that because it's important. So, you know, CTE is found in the deep crevices of the brain. And so when you think about that from a biomechanics or an engineering sort of point of view, the damage is being caused in the deep crevices of the brain, and then also this connecting part between the right and left brain, the corpus callosum. When you see damage in those two areas, that's telling you that it's coming from repetitive brain trauma.
Okay.
It's just the mechanism of injury of it. So absolutely. And when you go and look at like car crash studies on, you know, whiplash and diffuse axonal damage, and you think about it, if you add a 4 to 5 pound helmet on a 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 pound kid, you're just going to lower the amount of G-force necessary to cause the same damage without that heavy helmet.
Yeah.
So it certainly did just, it all added up and made perfect sense. He had problems with his knees and his back. So is it really that illogical to think that he had wear and tear on his joints from all the hits, but his brain was just sitting in there pristine? That's not logical. It makes perfect sense that you can't, human bodies are not intended to sustain hundreds of hits over a year and thousands over a lifetime. Mm. So just like workers in the workplace get overuse injuries from repetitive motion or, you know, tennis elbow or Tommy John from pitching in baseball, CTE or brain damage, it is really the same sort of type of injury. It's an overuse injury from too many hits.
How has American football changed from when Paul was playing it from the age of 7 to 15? Have they made changes that you're happy with, or do they still have a way to go?
You know, if you ask them, they would say it's a whole new game. It's never been safer. Parents are crazy to think that their kids shouldn't play. You know, the only change that American football can make for children is to stop letting them play tackle football. Young children cannot sustain those kind of hits. There's no equipment that can be made to make it reasonably safe. We don't know how many hits that they can take safely. Mm. You know, in 2018, we don't know how many cigarettes you can smoke to get lung cancer, but we don't give them to kids and let them keep smoking until we figure out how many cigarettes it takes, do we? It, the CTE and brain damage in football is really the same thing. The fact that we don't know how many hits it takes isn't an argument to keep playing. It's actually an argument that we should stop it immediately and stop exposing young children to permanent brain damage. There's no treatment. There's no cure. It's not reversible brain damage, and it's your operating system. Mm. You can live without an arm or your knees, but your brain, you only get one brain. There's no way to replace it. Mm. They've known since at least 1969 that the plastic helmets, you know, are causing more damage brain injury wise. While it's helping with skull fractures and other facial injuries, it's actually making other mechanisms of injury like brain injury and brain damage more probable.
Yeah.
That's an issue here in the U.S. because, you know, the defense in sports injury cases is that you assumed the risk. Well, it's a problem when you can't assume a risk that's never been measured. They can't tell you the probability of brain damage or CTE. Mm. So that's a problem. And when you add a 5 pound helmet on a 50 pound kid who just crawled out of a car seat in their parents' car that was never made for them, that increases the risk, you're becoming liable for selling a known defective product that can cause great bodily harm to children.
Mm. And so there are, the tackling still happens and there is still an issue with the helmet?
Correct. So, okay. You know, you have that, we don't know how many hits it takes. That's an issue. And then we have helmets that aren't made for kids that we know are too heavy, that lower the amount of G-force necessary to cause the damage that we know is occurring. So, you know, they've got to do flag football until kids are at least in high school. You know, society needs to understand the facts and make a decision. Is it 14? Is it 16? Is it 18? when should kids be allowed to assume a risk of repetitive trauma?
Yeah.
You know, then they need to fix the defects in the helmets. I'm not asking them to make a magic helmet to stop all brain injuries. I'm saying fix the problems that you've known about for 50 years so that they're not making brain damage worse.
Kimberly,
and then they're going to have to do a hit count and a hit limit, even for high school, college, or pros. At some point, college coaches are going to be looking for players with less repetitive hits. They're going to want people who started later and don't have all of the brain trauma. They're not going to want an athlete that's one hit away from being done.
Mm. I can only imagine the accusations of scaremongering which have landed on your door. You're out to ruin the game. You want to kill the game. How can we not have tackles will be a question for you. I'm sure that they're thrown at you. The kids need to learn how to tackle at a young age. I'm sure has been thrown at you. All these kind of accusations. How close are we to your message actually piercing through that nonsense?
I think we're right on the cusp, actually.
Okay.
You know, it's becoming more and more prevalent and common to see some of these talking points for protecting kids in sports in social media by random people, by the media, and also some of the organizations, as well as former pro athletes. So I think that it's right around the corner. I believe in the next 5 years, we'll see no tackle football before high school, changes in the helmets, and working on risk management to do a hit count and a hit limit. I mean, U.S. soccer already eliminated headers for kids 10 and under and are counting headers and limiting headers for kids 11 to 13.
Yeah.
So the legal precedent has already been set, and that was done a couple of years ago in a mediation for litigation against U.S. soccer. So I think that that's right around the corner. And obviously, I currently have a lawsuit on my son's behalf against Pop Warner Football. And I think that that litigation as well will help steer justice for kids and protect kids more in the future.
Mm. Yeah. Have other mothers been in touch with you, other parents been in touch with you, similar stories, similar kids who never played much in high school or never had big college careers or certainly never had pro careers, but whose children, sons have suffered with CTE?
Definitely. We have a group called Faces of CTE, and people can find information about us at facesofcte.com. And it's an organization, a grassroots effort by the families affected by CTE and brain damage. And we have dozens of families involved, from youth players to college players and pro players in American football, soccer, hockey, boxing, and even the military as well. So, and we even get people from domestic violence backgrounds and other areas outside of sports, too. Mm. So it's definitely a growing movement. We have a book coming out in October called Brain Damage, The Faces of CTE. And each chapter was written by a different family sharing their story of loss and now advocacy and how our stories of our family members that we've lost, how people knowing the symptoms and the signs can possibly get help before it's too late, and also to educate parents so that they can make an informed decision on whether they want their kids to play tackle football or any sport with repetitive brain trauma.
Well, I must say we're only starting the conversation about heading the football over here. And I think it's a big one as well, unfortunately. And I remember, it's a couple of years now that the US have banned heading of a soccer ball for under 10s. I didn't realize they were keeping count between 11 and 13. I think that's an issue we're gonna have to deal with very soon on this side of the pond, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree. And, most people don't realize that, sports equipment is not very regulated. Especially internationally, people see America as very litigious and that we sue everybody all the time.
Mm.
So one might assume that, sports equipment is highly regulated here, but it's actually not. It's not made with women in mind. It's not made with children in mind. And it's basically a self-regulated organization within the sports manufacturers and the sport governing body. So you don't have oversight from the federal government, and you don't have really good guidelines. So, for example, soccer balls are made for performance. So they don't test the soccer ball to see if at this PSI or that PSI it makes brain injury worse. They recommend a PSI for performance, for hitting it and kicking it, not for being hit with it. So the end user doesn't even know what is the proper PSI to not increase the risk if they happen to get hit with the ball or they're heading the ball. Mm. So I think that there are a lot of changes coming in the future in equipment as well that can help improve safety in sport.
Okay, well, Kimberly Archie is the founder of the National Cheer Safety Foundation, a leading expert on the prevention of child athlete maltreatment. And as I mentioned, her legal work has been used to settle more than 50 injury lawsuits, sports injury lawsuits, since 2008. Kimberly, thanks so much for your time. And I appreciate we're talking about devastating private issues for you as well and the death of your son. So thanks so much for talking to us this evening.
Thanks for having me and covering the topic. We hope we can make a difference.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.